Wake up with the news and information you can trust. This is the Andy Griffin Show on News Radio 890, 92.5 KDXU, Southern Utah's news talk leader.
November 5th is the day today, and a couple of things about today. Number one, it is National Donut Day. No, I'm not kidding about that. And number two, it is part of National Diabetes Awareness Month. And you would think, well, those two things kind of clash. We'll talk about that in a little bit. But Dr. David Blodgett is with me today from the Southwest Utah Public Health Department. Dave, how you doing, man?
It's great to be here. Thanks, Sandy.
Thank you for coming in. Is it okay if I have a donut occasionally?
Yeah.
It's occasional, right?
All things in moderation, right?
Yeah, exactly. David Heaton, who worked with you over there at the health department, was on earlier. He said, you know, if donut is one of the major food groups for you, you might have a problem, but the occasional one is not that big a deal, right?
Yeah, unfortunately, I think occasional or moderation is not something in most of our vocabulary. I think that's the problem. But
and that's fascinating to me because you think about maybe the best athlete ever. You could go like a LeBron James kind of guy or whatever. The ones that are really the best are the ones that obsess about one thing, and they become, right. they do it over and over and over and over and over and over again until they become incredible in it. That is fine for an athlete, but I think most people, like you and I, Dr. Blodgett, we don't want that much imbalance in our lives. We strive for a little bit more balance.
Yeah.
And so, but then a food group will come along, and we obsess about it. My wife right now is on a Take Five kick. She loves those Take Five candy bars. They're like Reese's with pretzels in them. But she's not overdoing it, but I'm just, we kind of get obsessed. For me, I grew up, my grandpa was a baker, owned three bakeries.
Okay.
Actually, I think at one point owned five, but anyway. And so to me, not only is having a donut, but the smell of donuts nostalgic or good, but it's also nostalgic for me. It brings back my youth and happier times. And so,
there's I think it's the wrong message to say none of that's ever acceptable again.
Yeah.
Right? I just think we've talked about this. We're trying to nudge in directions where we get a little more fruits and vegetables, a little less, but I don't think the message is ever, your life is never going to be your life again.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. Although oft times we keep hearing from, from health leaders, processed foods, man, you got to, and I don't think they ever said don't eat them, but they always say, well, they're kind of bad for you.
Yeah.
So, and by the way, how would we define processed foods? I when I think of processed foods, I think lunch meat and things like that, but it's more than that, right?
Yeah, it's probably a good thing to look at the ingredient list, and if it's got 47 preservatives, then that's a good indication of processing, right?
Okay.
So,
unfresh.
I don't know. I think a lot of people give up before they start when they hear the kind of more extreme, and so you get true believers in professions, right? And they, if you're a dietitian, you tend to think, wow, this is the end all of everything because you've read studies and you know it. The problem is it still has to fit into people's lives, right?
And
so, so I'm always an advocate of this more moderate, just be aware, fresh fruits and vegetables are better for you, and if you can move that way, then that's the way, that would be helpful. But I also think that we do more harm than good by trying to saying things like, well, if you're not a vegan, then you're not going to make it, because we still kind of intuitively know that's just not true. So,
it's kind of unrealistic to expect someone to be, for lack of a better word, be perfect in their diet, right? It's not going to happen.
Well, and truthfully, the body's much more forgiving on a lot of that stuff than we want to give it credit for, right? So, we have recommendations out there like, well, if you don't drink 8 cups of, glasses of water a day, then you're in trouble. And the reality is more water probably good, right? Flush some things out, but the kidneys are pretty darn good at keeping you hydrated and things like that. And so
good point.
So you There's a great study that just came out saying, is the 10,000 step a day thing reality, right? And they reviewed all the data, and it turns out, you know, you get really good added benefits for the first 3,000 steps that you add in a day. And then, good advancement for the next 3,000 and some advancement for the next 1,000 after that, but then it plateaus, right? And then you get to that J-shaped curve where if you're adding 12 or 15,000 steps, you're not doing well.
Actually,
but
hurting
the,
yourself.
But the sweet spot really looks like it's about 6 to 7,000 steps a day. And so, some of this stuff just takes on a life of its own, and it can be defeating, you know. 10,000 steps is the equivalent of basically 5 miles, mm-hmm. having walked 5 miles in the day. And I think that's really defeating for most people. But I think most of us, if we were to say, man, if I, no matter what, get 5,000 and hopefully get a little bit more sometimes, I think that's much more doable and something to think about, you know. So
yeah, reality is... I mean, everyday life in reality is something that you have to factor into all that.
Right.
When you give advice and you know this advice is never going to be followed, what's the point of even giving it, right? If you know they're not going to do that, so let's find something they will do.
Right. So, you know, I talk a lot about the big four. If you can bring all these four into line, then you'll cut out 70% of your chance for dying early and chronic disease and costs in healthcare and everything. And you know, so that's eating your 4 or 5 fruits and vegetables a day, exercising 30 minutes a day, not smoking, which hopefully is on the easier side.
By the way, there's a story about that in the news today. I'm going to talk about it in a second, but go ahead.
And maintaining a healthy body weight. And so those are – I want people to start with stuff like that, right? and the data is about 5 or 6% of us do that. And so there's a lot of work for all of us to look at this and just say, you know, I can nudge a little further down on some of those and really make a big impact. And so maybe the idea that if I don't run a marathon doesn't mean I'm not going to, die early. Maybe the fact that I can just get out and walk for 10 or 15 minutes a day is going to make a big impact, and it will. And those are the kinds of messages that I think that really need to be out there. So,
Diabetes Awareness Month. One of the things that you and I have talked about in the past, I thought maybe we could go over a little bit again, is people that are pre-diabetic. It's actually really common. I think it's 1 in 3. And guys especially, but not just guys, tend to do the kind of the head in the sand approach to it. In other words, if I don't know about it, if I don't get checked, it'll just go away. That's not true, is it?
No, it's not true. And in fact, it's really not wise, right? Mm. So the ability to stop the progression from pre-diabetes to diabetes is dramatic, right?
Yeah, phenomenal.
There's no reason to go from pre-diabetes to diabetes if you make some really basic changes to your lifestyle. But once you're diabetic, then it rules your life, right? You have to change your diet. You have to be on a medication schedule. You're at much higher risk for all kinds of things happening to you. It's a nasty, nasty disease. But in the pre-diabetic stage, if you say, you know what? So if you lose 5% of your body weight when you're pre-diabetic, you stop the progression from pre-diabetes to diabetes by about 70%, 5 to 7% of your body weight. Maybe that sounds hard, maybe it doesn't, but it's a whole different game than now I have to take my blood sugars 3 times a day and all of that kind of stuff, you know? And so, it's really worthwhile considering whether you have diabetes, and it's one of those core messages that I think makes a big difference in people's lives. So we have screening tools on our website and there at the office that you can take that'll tell you if you're at higher risk. This month, if you're at higher risk, we're willing to give you a free A1C just so you know. And then a lot of people say, I just don't want to know. And you're like, no, you do want to know, because the difference between living life with diabetes for the rest of your life and living life a little healthier is dramatic in your quality of life and in your life expectancy and just how good life is. So
to summarize, making a few little changes now, if you are pre-diabetic, if you find out you are, way, way easier and better than if you get to the full actually being diabetic and you're ruled by these new rules and, you know, insulin and things like, I mean, stuff that you don't want.
Yeah.
And we're going to talk in a minute about some of the complications that have to do with diabetes. I thought maybe, Dr. Bozzett, if you could, though, talk about some of the symptoms. Is there, and that's one of the hard things I think about being pre-diabetic, there aren't a ton of symptoms, right? Are there things, though, that we can look for?
Yeah, so almost all the time, there aren't a lot of symptoms when you're pre-diabetic. Once you're diabetic, then there's a lot of symptoms.
Right, right.
But pre-diabetic, maybe you notice you don't have as much energy. Maybe you are feeling really like it's difficult to just kind of engage energetically in life. It tends to come in a syndrome with a little bit of higher blood pressure, a little bit higher cholesterol levels called metabolic syndrome, a little bit of extra girth around the belly kinds of things. And all of that kind of adds up to this metabolic syndrome, which is then a precursor to everything else that can go along with that. So, and so that's when you're more likely to become diabetic and have true high blood pressure and all of that stuff. So that's the kind of warning signs we look for, and your doctor will screen for and try and give you some advice to help with. But
if, you know, it's not a guarantee. I was thinking about lifestyle. If you have a lifestyle that is high in sugar, there you're definitely increasing your odds of becoming pre-diabetic and then eventually diabetic, but it's not a guarantee. You know, everybody's different, and everybody handles these things differently.
Right. Well, and it's not the sugar itself that causes the diabetes. It's insulin resistance. Your body decreases in its capacity to deal with the sugar and know what to do with it, and because it's not sensitive to insulin. So it's not actually the sugar that causes it. It's the sugar that's the problem after you are diabetic, and that's why you always hear about, you know, sugar diabetes. But the actual development of diabetes is all about insulin sensitivity. So some of that can be related to genetics, but most of it is related to not doing things that increase sensitivity and doing things that decrease sensitivity, right? So the easiest one to increase your insulin sensitivity, which is always the answer, but nobody wants to hear it, is exercise, right? You just got to exercise. And that 15, 20, 30 minutes a day makes a world of difference in how sensitive your body is to the insulin and how easy it is for your body to manage and deal with the sugar level you have. You need sugars. You don't need tons of sugars, but right, that's what your brain functions on. So you got to have this balance of all of that. But it's just, can your body process the sugars anymore? And that tends to happen because of lifestyle choices. So diabetes is a modern world phenomenon. Even as soon in medical history as the generation before me as a physician, they rarely saw diabetes.
Yeah.
Very, very, very rare thing. Yeah. Now it's incredibly common. Probably 10% of the population right now has diabetes, and that's a big deal.
By the way, yesterday Marianne Hamilton was on. We talked about exercises that aren't really exercise, things you can do, as Dr. Blodge is talking about, getting that exercise. Simple things like going for a walk, right, or, you know, Dr. Blodgett always likes to talk about everybody's trying to get the best parking spot when actually, you know, you could park across the parking lot and that would do the trick for you. If you're going to go to Walmart, park far away, walk in and walk around the store, walk back out, and all of a sudden you got your 30 minutes in.
Yeah, it doesn't have to be hyper hardcore.
Yeah, you don't have to be doing aerobics or Pilates or anything like that. You know,
we once had a challenge at this work site that I was doing a pilot project with, where we just encouraged people to take the stairs, you know, and we gave them awards when they hiked up the equivalent of different mountains and stuff like that. But it was remarkable. People lost inches off of their belly fat and, you know, things like that just by just by making a conscientious effort just to take the stairs instead of taking the elevator. And so I don't want people to view this as like this endless drudgery. It can be enjoyable. It can be fun. Walking is probably about as good an exercise as there is. And, just getting, you know, being maybe not lumbering along, but, walking purposefully, has all these studies to show it just has incredible benefits for your long-term health. So,
well, and too, the thing with exercise is do something that you enjoy. I like pickleball. We play pickleball. We do a ton of walking. When, you know, it's funny, everybody talks about cruises. My wife and I have been on a couple of cruises. I've lost weight every time I've gone on a cruise. Everybody's like, oh, you're going to gain weight, the buffet and all the great food. Well, we walk so much. I was getting, one day I had 18,000 steps. Another day I had 12 or 13, most days I had 12 or 13,000. So I was actually losing weight even though I was eating good. Because I was walking everywhere and I enjoyed it.
Yeah, so. And it goes into a context of if it's fun, right? So find places you want to go explore and see and just get out and walk.
Okay, say we don't catch it in time, we get diabetes. I'm on the American Diabetes website. Diabetes.org is the website, but they talk about some of the things that can happen to you, and some likely will happen to you if you get diabetes. I thought we could go over some of these. Some of these we'll just kind of hurry through, but others I'm like, wow, that's a big one. Let's start with chronic kidney disease. Now, I have been diagnosed with mild or low-grade chronic kidney disease. I asked my doctor about it. He says it's actually relatively common, especially among men. Can you address that? Obviously, it's something that diabetes affects.
Yeah. Well, so when you have a high sugar level and the sugars are not being absorbed into your body, but they end up getting dumped through your kidneys, that's very destructive to your kidneys. So there's lots of things that can cause kidney damage and kidney problems, but the number one cause of kidney failure is diabetes right now. Yeah. So something to pay attention to. It the mechanisms of the kidney are really intricate and delicate, you know, and very common for people to over the course of their lifetime do things that will ultimately damage their kidneys to where they just function at a much lower level. Or fortunately, we have two. It's one of the things that the urologists say. But even then, you can end up with a remarkably changed lifestyle because of your kidneys' inability to function properly. Mm.
Another one of them, diabetes-related eye disease. Now, you don't think about, you know, diabetes affecting your vision as much, at least the average person does. Tell us how diabetes and eye issues.
Right. So sometimes when I lecture on diabetes, I always say, well, the only places that can be impacted by diabetes are places that have a blood supply. So
that would be everything.
And so the question is, what does that look like? So in diabetics, you see very characteristic changes to the retina and bleeding into the posterior portions of the eyes, you know, things that make it that can take. So again, we're in the most things that are most common, but the most common cause of blindness,
diabetes.
So
wow.
So most people that are long-term diabetics have really significant issues with their eyes and have to be, you know, constantly trying to use laser surgery to try and repair some of those bleeding blood vessels in the retina of the eye and things like that that are really very difficult for people. So maintaining eye health is a primary consideration for people with diabetes, and you spend a lot of time and effort trying to keep your eyes. So
one of them that's really common when you hear about diabetics is they have circulation problems relating to especially their feet, but their hands as well. Neuropathy.
Yes.
Tell us. So I have neuropathy in my feet. The first question doctors always ask me when I see a new doctor, are you diabetic?
Yeah.
The answer actually is no, I am not diabetic. They call it idiosymptomatic for me. They don't know why I have neuropathy. But diabetes and neuropathy generally walk hand in hand, don't they?
Right. So that's another common complication is you don't have good blood flow, it's decreased circulation, and you have actual damage to the nerves as a result of all that extra sugar that builds up in there. So so a sister to that is you end up with the inability to heal wounds, and so the leading cause of amputation is actually diabetes.
Wow.
So losing a hand or an arm or a foot, mostly in the lower limbs, and that is much more common in diabetics as well. So you've got these really dire consequences, but not being able to feel your feet can lead to difficulties with, you know, you injure yourself, you don't really know it.
And, I've done that.
So you have to be really diligent about your foot care in diabetes, and you have to be really aware of the fact that, you know, if you have damage on your feet and or you don't take care of your nails or something like that, you can end up really with significant issues that are difficult to deal with. And so all of this is just better not to get, right? That's why getting away from diabetes is a good thing.
And we're not trying to scare people, but I just want to make people aware that if you get diabetes, it affects, as you, what'd you say, any part of your body that actually needs blood.
Right.
Yeah. That's everything, folks. And there's a couple of other complications involved with getting diabetes. We're going to talk about when we come back. Did you know diabetes can affect your hearing? Did you know your diabetes can affect your digestive system, your heart? It's all there. And these aren't things we're guessing at or making up. These are real, established, unfortunately, facts and complications. We'll take a weather break and be back to talk about that when we come back. Hang with us here.
All the latest news, weather, traffic, and sports, just like you like them. You're waking up with the Andy Griffin Show on News Radio 890, 92.5 KDXU, Southern Utah's news talk leader.
Welcome back. I'm Andy, 935 on KDXU. I've got a couple of winners, and I need to go through my texting. Got a lot of texts this time. I know a lot of people love going to Angelica's. I know I do. Dr. Blungeon is with me today on the Andy Griffin Show. We're talking about right now some of the complications. If you let it slip, if you go pre-diabetic, don't really catch it, and don't change your lifestyle, and you end up diabetic, here are some of the complications. What listed on this list, hearing loss. Now, Dr. Blodgett talked about anything that needs blood flow is going to be affected by this. Hearing loss is one of those things. Tell us about that a little bit.
Yeah, you don't hear about it as much, but definitely.
No pun intended, right?
Yeah. Okay.
Sorry.
That was good. I don't know what to say to add on to that. It just can be one of the constellation of symptoms that you end up with, you know. So the problem is you have the level of sugar you have in your bloodstream is extremely oxidative, right? So you get damage to whatever. And so when you've got when the mechanisms that keep your kind of oxidant antioxidant balance in place are overwhelmed because you're just not getting the sugar out of there, then it's called glycosylation. You start sticking sugars on everything.
And oh wow.
So that's the way you measure A1C is how much of the surface of red blood cells is glycosylated, is has this sugar attached to it. And and that can happen anywhere, right? So you start tacking on those sugar molecules and have an antioxidant, an oxidative effect on your hearing cells, and you end up with hearing loss and
this
difficulty.
Is maybe a crude comparison, but it's almost like I've been septic in the past where there's poison in my blood. It's
right.
Kind of like that, where something's in the blood that's not supposed to be there, and it affects everything that needs blood.
One of the concepts that's really important in medicine is the homeostatic mechanisms that we have. So not enough of something is bad, too much of something is bad, right? And so the body has all these ways to try and keep things in this narrow range where it's good. And unfortunately, the effects of too much sugar constantly in your system are really dramatic over time, right? So
here's some numbers for you on hearing loss. The rate of hearing loss is 30% higher in those with normal blood glucose than if you have diabetes. And it's 50% if you have diabetes, 30% higher if you have pre-diabetes. Those are pretty staggering numbers.
Yeah, and I don't know that it's the number one cause of hearing loss. That's probably, you know, loud music in your teenage years. But
being in radio for 30-something years, yeah.
But I think it fits right in there with particularly age-related hearing loss. And, you know, it's hearing's difficult to... I mean, there's all these impacts for having hearing loss that we don't really talk about. You know, loneliness decreases your ability to learn and to interact socially, and to they actually have a lower intelligence level when you can't hear, right? So that's why hearing aids really make an improvement in that. So protecting your hearing, something very important to consider.
Okay. One of the other symptoms, complications, things that happen, not symptoms, complications that happen when you have diabetes. How about diabetic ketoacidosis, DKA, they call it. Tell us what that means.
So ketoacidosis is actually part of the continuum. So when you're not processing your sugars and your body's trying to keep up with that, one of the things it can do is start to spin that sugar into ketosis. So as you build that up, that's when somebody goes into a diabetic coma and stuff like that. It's because they're in diabetic ketoacidosis. You can't process it. It's not productive for your brain. It's that's the danger of dying quickly. And so it's interesting because ketoacidosis itself is kind of on a spectrum. So some diets seek to put you in a mild ketoacidosis because that can help with weight loss. Yeah. And so your brain can actually burn ketones.
The keto diet, people are talking
about. The keto diet is. Yeah. And so some isn't bad, a lot definitely is. So it's all in that, you know, within the bounds kind of thing. So
okay, I've left the two biggest ones for last, complications of having diabetes. Number two is stroke. If you have diabetes, your chances of having a stroke are twice as high than in people without diabetes. Explain what a stroke is and why diabetes can make that worse.
Yeah, so stroke, blockage of the blood flow to your brain. Third leading cause of death in the United States. Not something you want.
Yeah.
Right? So it causes numbness, tingling, loss of function in parts of your body, whether it's half of your body,
which could be the brain,
most common, or could be all of your body. So they're talking about, though, mostly, well, you can have hemorrhagic strokes, which is a rupture of a blood vessel, or you can have a clogging stroke where you clot the blood vessels, and both of them are more likely in diabetes. And the scenarios are not good.
Life-changing in a bad way.
We always talk about getting there fast to the hospital and things like that, but always better to not have that happen. So.
Okay, and the number one complication with diabetes, cardiovascular disease, is the leading cause of death in people with diabetes. But with a healthy lifestyle that includes exercise and an eating plan, you can reduce your CVD risk and other complications. But heart disease, cardiovascular disease it's America's killer.
Yeah, it's taken over, right? So 2/3 of men, half of women will die with cardiovascular disease. And diabetes exacerbates that risk and just makes it younger, right? So, where you might live to be the average age in America now, 85, 86, 87, depending on your circumstances, you know, that drops it down into that kind of 60 to 70 range when you're a diabetic. So all the same mechanisms, and harder work on your system to keep pumping, and more likely to have clogging in your arteries, all of the stuff that leads to heart attacks. So
diabetes is a killer, folks. I mean, there's no other way to say it. With all the complications, I didn't even go over all. I left three or four of them out. There are so many things that can kill you or make your life miserable if you end up being diabetic. Yeah. Now, the health department is offering free
screenings and then tests for pre-diabetes right now. It's right. Absolutely free.
For the whole month.
For Diabetes Awareness Month. So
yeah, so this is Diabetes Awareness Month because it's the birthday of the guy that discovered insulin. So that's why they put it in this month. But
and he never got rich off of that, by the way.
No, no. He just donated that to science. He's a good guy.
I wish I could remember his name.
Yeah, his name is escaping me right now, of course. Yeah, so, but we're, so the idea is the screening test gives you a scored number, and if you score above a certain.
And when you say test, it's like three or five questions, right? It's not like it's 25 questionnaire.
It's not hard. And there are things that you know can be a risk, whether you've had family members that are diabetic, whether you've, where your BMI is, you know, things like that. And so, your age actually factors in there to give you a higher risk.
I'm about to hit the 60, so I'm about to be in a higher risk category.
That's just an opportunity to take more, chances to deal with it.
Yeah.
We'd love to see people come in and we run out of tests, but it's never happened for us. So it's a significant investment on our part. Those tests are not cheap, and we'd love to be of an assistance to people to, you know, so if you already know you're diabetic, that's not the kind of people we're looking for. We're looking for people that don't know, that haven't been diagnosed, but score high on that test so they can know and make plans for themselves how to deal with this.
Let's go ahead and first of all, good news about diabetes and the future of Americans. There was a study that came out, we talked about it last month, how by 2050 60% of Americans were going to be considered obese, and you said I take issue with those numbers because there are some technological improvement things that are changing that, and the big one of course is the emergence of semaglutides and getting people to I kind of said early, look, we don't know the long-term results of some of these, but we do know this. It is saving people right now, because if you can go from being 50 pounds overweight, going on a semaglutide, to being not overweight, or, you know, being morbidly obese to being just overweight, that's huge, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm trying to be objective about all of this, and I'm not sure exactly where it's all going to fall out. I think there's a lot of euphoria around it right now, I think there probably will be other things to consider in this. I think it's going to be a big part of medicine, to be honest with you, going forward. And if you look at the pipeline of medications coming in this arena, there's a huge variety of... So they're starting to combine... So GLP-1 agonists is what, like, Ozempic is. And then you add a GP-1 agonist in there. But then there's a new medication that adds glucagon on there, which is the offset to insulin. And then there's another one that's looking at GP-1 antagonist, and it turns out to be really good. So there's all of these combinations of these their hormones that are related to how you process glucose, how you metabolize, how you send signals to the brain that you're hungry and full, and how fast you move things through your gut. And I think we're going to get to a place where the Wegovys of the world were primitive compared to some of the newer stuff that we have.
Right.
There's just some fascinating implications for medicine here, right? Can you afford to put two-thirds of your population on a medicine that costs $1,500 a month?
Yeah.
No, not really, right?
And especially a medicine that if you ever go off of it, you're immediately...
You bounce right back up. And can you get to a combination of medicines that continue to help go down, right? Because if you lose 15 or 20%, that's awesome. But for some people, that's just not enough to have all the impacts they want. But... for a lot of people, like we talked about, if you can get that 5, 7, 10% off, which is what almost everybody that goes on these does, then you are much less likely to progress to diabetes. So do you screen people for pre-diabetes and then give all of them the medication? But, man, that's a trillion-dollar figure or something like that, right? And so, and I haven't done the math. Don't check my math on that one. But but it's just expensive. And so what... This will be interesting to see how this progresses as we go forward. So,
do you feel like there's any truth in the in that these companies that make these, you know, Wegovy, Ozempic, et cetera, are charging more than they need to because they know they're going to cost themselves money in the other medications where if you stayed obese in the long run, I mean, it's hard to not be cynical and say, yeah, that's why they're doing that.
Well, I think there's lots of reasons why they do that. Okay. One is there's high cost to develop a drug. So, sure. so that's the more
R&D, right?
That's the more, pure reason in all of this. But number two is they can charge it because they've got a medicine that everybody wants and there's high demand for it, right?
Yeah. Supply and demand,
Number three, the shelf life, it looks like, on these medications is going to be pretty short because these new generations will come in, right? So they got to try and get as much money out of it as they can. Unfortunately, the pharmaceutical industry is very profit driven, right? And and that, I think, impacts some of these discussions as well. The true cost to manufacture Wegovy, for example, is like 64 cents or something like that, you know, and they're charging $1,200, you know, a month. So it's, I don't know. Do you start so then you start talking about, well, the old patent system was 18 years, but that's way too long in a modern system. So maybe you give them a year and then you're off patent. I don't know. I don't know what the solution will be, but as a society, if this ends up being something that, and then, truthfully, right now, probably about 40% of people that start a GLP-1 agonist stop it because the side effects are too hard on them. Yeah. And so it's not the ultimate magic bullet, but it's definitely better than anything we've ever had to this date. So I don't know. I'm cautiously optimistic that we're into a realm where we might be able to see a true dent in this really bleak picture, which was obesity going forward, right? So,
all right, got to pay some bills. Be back in 3 minutes.
Wake up with the news and information you can trust. This is the Andy Griffin Show on News Radio 890, 92.5 KDXU, Southern Utah's news talk leader.
9:53 on KDXU. Dr. Blodgett is here with me. This was on the wire this morning. I thought this was interesting, and I'm going to preface it with this. I don't run into a lot of people that smoke. Fortunately, because of my lifestyle and where I live and everything, just don't see a lot of smokers. I went to Amsterdam last year, and I couldn't believe the number of people that smoke out there in Europe. And then this story on the wire this morning. Chicago Transit has a smoking problem. Officials say they are getting tens of thousands of smoking complaints. The transit authorities say they have received 14,000 email complaints through the agency chat box over a 14-month period of people smoking on the non-smoking subway.
Yeah.
I'm like, wait a minute. I guess I keep thinking we're getting there. Smoking is almost gone. You know, it says right on the box, this will kill you, et cetera. I'm like, we're getting there, but apparently we're not yet.
Yeah, you know, it's pretty stubbornly staying at that right about 20% range.
Wow.
And I don't know. I mean, when you look at kids, which, you know, they feed into adult smokers, the rates of smoking are much lower, kind of in that 5 or 6% range. But then you got lots of vaping going on.
Yeah. Right?
So they're substituting one for the other. But I don't know. Does that mean as smokers die off that we're going to see less smoking? I don't have a good sense for that. But for some reason, now here in our district, we've always been in that kind of 9 or 10% range. But nationwide, that number sticks right at that 20% number.
It's still, if you think about it, our district, the five counties in southern Utah, 9 or 10% of people,
right,
of all people that live there in the smoke. I mean,
It's still 20,000 people, right?
That's so a lot of people.
Yeah.
And we're not talking about that doesn't count vapors, right? That's just smokers.
That's just smokers.
Just smokers.
Right.
Wow.
Yeah. Tobacco. And when I think there's a lot more fluidity between some of that stuff too, right? You do Zen and smoke. And so maybe it's not just one or the other, but there's still, even with all of the effort we've put into trying to get smoking down, it's still just persists right at that 20%
level. Crazy. So. I want to do a couple of quick hits because we only have 3 minutes left. Measles, I guess Colorado City, Hilldale, so the border there, Utah, Arizona, they're over 100 between the two places. That's a crazy number, isn't it?
Yeah, well, probably 150.
Wow, 150.
Between Hilldale and Colorado City. We've talked about it. It's, if you're not vaccinated, you're vulnerable, and it's just, there's just not a lot that you can do other than get vaccinated. So we continue to say it's here, and if you don't want measles, we have a way to avoid that. If you do get measles, then there can be consequences to that, and we'll keep moving on. So.
Okay, they rehashed that story about the frozen pasta and listeria, saying the latest story said it actually was in Utah, too. There were a couple of cases in Utah. They didn't give any details beyond that, but listeria has killed, I think they said it's killed 6 people because of a certain pasta that was sold. And you have to go online and read all more about it, but I hear listeria, I think, what's the big deal? But it's actually killing people.
Yeah, gastrointestinal illnesses, when you eat or drink food that is contaminated, mm-hmm. can be really significant. And if you're fragile and you're on the tipping point anyway, it can be what. So, you know, there's probably several million salmonella cases a year and probably 2,000 or 3,000 deaths from salmonella. And you just think it's not that big
a
deal.
But, yeah, but, named after a fish, big deal, right?
That's right. But if you're vulnerable, it can be. So we have a very good recall system. Let people know about things that are a problem. Stores are very responsive to pull things off their shelves. But you know the, and so the food delivery system is much better than it's ever been. But still, we're talking about things that can get contaminated, and they just do sometimes, right?
They do sometimes. So. I had a good friend that listens to the show quite often, ate a can of soup, had a pinprick or something in it. It had been dented, and the soup in it was, he got really bad, almost died from food poisoning from a can of soup. Yeah. Who'd have thunk, right?
Yeah, we live in this world where we just don't recognize that, but food poisoning and contaminated food has been with humankind from the beginning, so, and it probably always will be, but we're the safeguards put in place, it's something to be really grateful for, that there's people out there monitoring food and trying to keep it safe. And so these recalls that you hear about, you know, listeria, whatever, that's the food safety network that does a pretty darn good job of keeping the food where it needs to be.
We can be mad at the FDA for, you know, approving a certain dye for too long or whatever, but it is, I think, for the most part, is looking out for us.
Yeah, so. Absolutely. There are certain functions that you really want done.
Dr. David Blodgett, head of the Southwest Utah Public Health Department. Go to swuhealth.gov to take that little screening test about prediabetes. And then if your thing says you need to be tested, it's free in the month of November.
This month. We want you there.
Very good. Thank you, Dr. Blodgett, for coming in. It's always a pleasure, my friend.
Sure. Great to be here with you, Andy. Thank you for everything you've done.
Thank you so much. We're out of time. Tomorrow, Jimmy, new mayor Jimmy, will be on the program. We'll see you then.